We are creatures of desire. What we most desire is meaning. What makes us suffer most is a lack of meaning.
The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. Marital therapist, author, and communications trainer Andrew G. Marshall invites guests from all walks of life to discuss what makes life meaningful.
Hello, I'm Andrew G. Marshall, and welcome to The Meaningful Life. We're available on Apple, Spotify, Podbeam, and wherever you find your podcasts. How do you know that you have been traumatized? There is a lot on social media about trauma, and the word is used in everyday language more and more. My clients often ask me, have I been traumatized? Perhaps in response to discovering their partner's infidelity or after thinking about their childhood. It's always difficult to answer because trauma is a very personal response to an experience which overwhelms your body, emotions, and thoughts. So on the podcast, we're taking a deep dive into trauma. Would it be helpful to have a trauma diagnosis? If it is, what treatment is available? My guest is Jeremy Fox, who's a licensed mental health therapist in Georgia, USA, and he is also an MDR trauma counselor. EMDR stands for Eye Movement Desensitization and Reprogramming, and has published in the Journal of EMDR Practice and Research. Before we look specifically at trauma, let's get to know you a little bit better. What do you think in your childhood prepared you to become a therapist?
Oh, that's a great question. Growing up in the South, here in America and US, you get to watch all kinds of dynamics. And I think it's the same maybe in any culture, but you kind of learn surface level interactions and you learn the deeper things beyond it, right? Like what something can really mean. There's kind of this cultural trope here of like the term bless your heart, meaning basically, oh, how naive, right? And so kind of learning sub-communication might have been a key thing there. I really enjoyed, as wild as this may sound, art and literature in my youth, and also the idea of becoming a doctor. And so in high school, I really discovered this, what I would almost call a middle road of the interpretive and the medical of psychotherapy, and reading about Freud and how he opened people's lives as case studies in medical fashion, but also with an eye for themes and almost literary motifs was deeply appealing to me. And I knew as a teenager that I wanted to go into something of psychology.
And what drew you to trauma? Because, I mean, it's a hard boat to row, trauma.
It is. Yeah, it's a light topic, isn't it? So initially setting out and then deciding to go the more clinician route in the psychology field, because as we know, research, clinician, they're complementary, but divergent in some ways. I decided on becoming a clinician, and I was very interested in narrative therapy at the time and still find it great. But when I started my career, I worked at what's called a community mental health center, and in different even states in the U.S. here, in different countries, I'm sure have different terms for it. But basically, it's where people with government-issued health insurance can go for treatment. And usually these places have a very large client base, and there's differing diagnoses from schizophrenia to bipolar disorder to PTSD. And I had a mentor who was EMDR trained and was actually a consultant. And we'll talk more about EMDR. But this person taught me to view so many mental health conditions as exacerbated, as influenced, and even set off by trauma. And so we call that a trauma-informed lens. And it's a big wave right now in the psychotherapy world. And once I started to see that and see the impact that the reliving of trauma can have on people, and then the power of reprocessing therapies like EMDR, and there are others too, I really began to see, wait a minute, even though this is the darkest of what is part of the human condition, when we address this, the prognosis is spectacular.
So let's get down to brass tacks. What is trauma as far as you're concerned?
So as far as I'm concerned, I really lean on definitions from people like Peter Levine, who's written heavily on it. He's an expert in the field, and he has really a quite practical definition, I think. So any unresolved autonomic nervous system response and the nervous system's response to the event, and not simply labeling the event itself. And so there's a lot of tricky sticking points now with that term trauma. Like, what's trauma? What isn't? Is everything trauma? And then conversely, the old school attitude of just kind of get over it. So you've got these spectrums, right, of everything's trauma and then nothing's trauma and just kind of toxic positivity denial. But when we look at trauma, we recognize, okay, it's how it's formed in the brain. So if someone is so shocked or taken aback and in a state of psychological shock, their brain, what we've discovered, is the amygdala, that emotion center that's subcortical, so inside the brain, activates, and the quality of the memory stored from that event is different than when you or I are going about our daily lives and we, you know, go through the drive-thru, grab a cup of coffee, go drive to work. Those things are very linear in our minds. But when we see something that's so shocking that our sympathetic nervous system response, which is the fight or flight response, activates, and a cascade of chemicals are released, that event is often stored in a fragmented way. So later, when we smell something that reminds us of maybe the attack we went through, we feel like we're there. So it's the feeling as though you're there.
So it's just as important, if not more important, the response than the particular event.
Yes, I would exactly put it that way.
And people talk about trauma with a capital T and trauma with a small t. Now, what is the difference between the two? And do you find this a helpful idea or not?
Yeah, I actually find it a relatively helpful idea. So when we look at uppercase T trauma, we have things like assault. We have things like brushes with death. So traumatic car accidents. Anything like that that jars the nervous system to that level, that's a great way to think about it, a harrowing experience. And so the lowercase t traumas, things that are more cumulative. So, you know, being frightened when your parents argue, like there's sympathetic jump there in the nervous system, not quite to the level of thinking you're going to die. Maybe that can occur too, but those are usually more developmental in nature. So things that may happen that involve shame, and we can really get to that, but they're not considered that life and death category.
But you're more likely to get them repeatedly because your parents could argue every night. I mean, hopefully not. Right. You're not hopefully not going to feel that you're going to be in a car accident or you're going to live for right. all of your life in a war zone, for example.
Absolutely. Hopefully you wouldn't feel that way. But then when we see with PTSD, people reminded with sensory elements, things that take them back there, they often can live and feel that way, that they need to be on alert for those type of events, like fireworks with veterans, like triggering that fight or flight response.
Now, do you think it's actually helpful if you're sort of sitting on the fence? You know, my parents were loving, but, you know, they argued all the time, or I grew up gay and they were not accepting of that. And people are sort of, they're on the fence, you know, is this trauma, isn't this trauma? Do you think it's useful for them to explore this? Or are they sort of sending themselves down a rabbit hole?
Great question. So I would say it's helpful to explore it with the lens that trauma is not something wrong with you. It's something that happened to you. Now, it does impact the nervous system. And there, you can say there are things that happen that change how you relate to that memory and how your body responds to it. But I think we have to be more empowering about how we view it. There is hope. There is a way to get through that. We know prognosis is great when people receive EMDR therapy, or we could say trauma-informed cognitive behavior therapy. So I would liken it to receiving the proper diagnosis, and then rather than identifying solely as that diagnosis and saying, that's my trauma, that's just part of me, that's not going to change, saying, no, wait a minute, what are these symptoms? How can I intervene and purify this as much as possible and put it behind me? Because if you don't have the map and know how to get through that kind of dark forest, then you may keep stumbling through it. And it's not nice to know there's a dark forest in your map, but you can deny it, or you can say, no, I'm stuck in this forest. And so either one of those is not the optimal path. It's that middle way of, I can see this, and this was something that affected me, but I want it behind me. And so you can also just refer to it as developmental challenges. You don't have the T word, it, like many things, like other terms that become overused, can kind of leave a bad taste in people's mouth and a taste of helplessness. And so just looking at it's a past thing that continues to kind of feel relevant, even though I know I'm whatever age I am. When I think of this from my parents, I might feel like I'm there. It's like, okay, you could even just call it that. You could say the feeling of being there negatively or something like that.
And I think I want to say that just because it happened to lots of other people doesn't mean that it wasn't traumatic. So, you know, it's all very well to say, you know, one of my parents died when I was 7 years old. It happens to lots of people, and therefore it can't be traumatic. I would say losing a parent when you're a child is traumatic.
Yes, absolutely. Many things can happen to many different people, but it's our unique temperaments. It's our developmental history up to the point of the traumatic event. And then it's the support we have afterward that all sort of conspire together to influence how we respond to traumatic events.
I'm sure you know the work of Gabor Mate. And he says a lot of people hide behind, I had a happy childhood defense. So you label your childhood as happy, and then you put that sign on the door, and then you never open the door again. And he asks the question, who did you talk to? When you had a problem, who did you talk to? Now, what do you think of that question, and why is it such an important question?
Well, I love that question, and so many different rich points there are coming up. I'll answer your direct question first. I would say what we know about resilience is that when you've experienced a traumatic event and you've had your sense of safety shaken to its core, who you have to debrief with, who you have that you can seek out as a safe base or anchor, to use some attachment type jargon there, can make all the difference in the world. We know that child survivors of sexual abuse often find the other parent's response to the abuse worse than abuse itself if it's denial or saying that didn't happen to you, right? So that's the worst outcome of that, is someone being abused and then when they try to talk to someone about it, it's completely rebuffed and dismissed, right? And so conversely, when someone has a severely negative experience, maybe they've been bullied or being bullied actively, or something has occurred that really causes them to feel that they're fundamentally unsafe, and they have a supportive grandmother or a mentor at school, a guidance counselor, a family friend who can say, wow, this is really terrible, and I'm here, and you can talk to me about this. That is magnificently supportive and helps to bolster that person's capacity for coping.
Because I think one of the most saddest, I think, is that nearly always when you ask people that question, who did you have to talk to? The answer is, after a little bit of thought, nobody.
Right. Well, when you realize that we ask certain questions in culture, like, you know, how are you? And then the answer is supposed to be fine, thanks, right? And you have a superficial level of communication. People are just unaware of how to have these conversations. And here's another fun concept to throw in. It's not so fun. Intergenerational trauma, in those gaps in capacity for holding space and emotion, you may have parents who themselves have adopted that my childhood was fine sort of persona, a very thin kind of ego state there. And when their children come to them with a problem, they can't hold the space for that. They can't have a conversation. And then the cycle of emotional denialism perpetuates.
And it is amazing, because one of the jobs of a couple therapist is to sort of take a bit of a family history and see how things have been coming through the generations. It's amazing how much material that happened in the grandparents' generation that's having a huge impact, not directly, but, you know, when somebody says, oh, yes, my grandfather was an alcoholic or my grandmother killed herself, often this is just a fact.
Yes.
But actually, what the impact might have been and how it's filtered through the generations has been sort of minimized, which is, I have to say, one of the main themes when you're trying to help people decide if, you know, trauma is a useful thing to look at, is you have to try and take away the minimization of some of this material.
Yes, you do. You have to go through the generations of filtering, almost as if you're looking at a water filter or an air purifier. They'll have different levels of that, right? And we can look at the ego defenses accumulating through grandparents, parents, us. So it's already been through this denialism and repression process And then we as psychotherapists may be going through and examining this filter and saying, okay, what was our response to this just unbelievably grievous loss or occurrence that happened? And are we reacting to this in some way that ultimately just sweeps enough dust under the rug that it's collecting and the rug is piling up? And it's like, we need to clean under that. And rather than saying, no, that rug looks fine.
So if somebody is sitting here thinking, what are the clues that would help them decide whether this is something useful for them to look into further?
Whether they've had trauma.
I'm thinking in particular of their behavior today that sort of are classic trauma responses to something.
Mm-hmm. Brilliant question. So we could look at it and how it manifests in attachment, so that we know that people with anxious attachment will often overreact to some sorts of gaps in communication with a significant other or distance, or will overread into things sometimes. And we can say, well, part of that may be temperament, right? But also, what did a slight pulling away or someone being unavailable slightly mean in the past to your earlier attachments to a parent, like in someone with avoidant attachment? And I'm not trying to give one little heuristic here, but it's helpful to look at. With avoidant attachment, you learn essentially early on, attachment is dangerous. So I need my physical needs met, or I need needs met in a way that are clinical. But ultimately, if I'm attached to someone, that's going to hurt me. And so if you look at attachment or human relationships in a very sort of protective or cynical way, that's a great clue that maybe some earlier things happen. People often know that. But if there's gaps in your memory, if the very thought of something in your past triggers you greatly, and triggering is another big word now. What does it mean? It means a triggering of the nervous system and a feeling of great tension and hypervigilance, which is a great multi-syllabic word basically for being extremely on edge and vigilant and ready. And so if there are points in your life, if there are particular memories that you really just have put into this box and said, I'm fine, everything's fine, then that might be an indication that you're essentially having to dedicate some psychic energy to not thinking about memories that were pretty significant.
So triggering is very much the response is sort of out of, on the surface level, out of response. So, for example, say if I'd turned up 10 minutes late for this recording and you were thinking, oh my gosh, you know, he doesn't want me on the program.
Right.
That would be an example of it, rather than, you know, I was perfectly on time, but let's imagine, you know, I had a technical problem and I was late. Most people would think, oh, he's having a technical problem, or perhaps I've got the date wrong. They wouldn't think that I would have invited you on the program and then not showed up because I didn't really want you. That's a sort of over-the-top response, isn't it?
It is. It is. And so now we get into the different narratives that are created by past experience. And so if someone learned not to trust, and that a parent was maybe chronically late to pick them up at school, or if the parent continued to say, I'm going to go to that sports game, I'm going to go watch your little league or your football, and then the parent had a substance abuse issue and would just not show up and be intoxicated. I mean, and this is stuff that happens to people. And then they still may say, you know, childhood was okay enough. Then what happens? Well, when that person's missing that they were expecting, and that expectant sense is shattered, okay, then that same familiar feeling of dropping in the chest and sinking and, oh, they're not here, kind of sends that person back into that younger ego state, or in other words, mood or a reaction with its own age. It was established, that memory network was established at a much younger age. And so you've got an adult there, 20s, 30s, 40s, inhabiting the thought space of maybe a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old. And if you talk to them, they'd be able to engage you as an adult on logical matters, but their emotional sense at that point and level of rational thought would probably be this, you know, very simplistic of, oh, this means I'm being rejected. And so we have people walking around, we have a lot of interesting emotional responses. I'm sure you see this in couples work of, you know, someone's petulant teenage ego state, or again, just memory network coming up, and someone else being more childlike. And you've got like a 15-year-old and a 10-year-old arguing when it's two 40-year-olds physically in the office.
You've been watching my practice, haven't you? You've got a camera in there. So You can have overreactive, and then you can have the opposite end, sort of being immobilized. Yes. So tell me about that.
Absolutely. So we talk often about fight or flight. Those have entered the cultural conscious. And even now, the third F of freezing or immobilization, I think more people know about, which all the better. So freezing is a big response that Peter Levine talks about. Bessel van der Kolk talks about. Body Keeps the Score. Great book. Love it. So if we can't fight or flee from a traumatic event, right, then we freeze. We enter a shutdown state. Now, why does that happen versus fight or flight? Well, if as a child, we do this mental calculus instinctually. It's exquisite. As human beings, we have this capacity, like with something's happening, we fight, we flee. And then if we could kind of make that judgment, oh, I can't do either of those things, there's the freeze response. And so usually that's seen younger with children, or if you're an adult and there's absolutely no escape, then there's the freeze response as well. But it's so much easier for children to switch into that because they don't legitimately have the ability to fight an adult or flee and get away and drive in their car or something. Like, so the freeze response is typically one that can lead to what we would call dissociation or zoning out, you know, going somewhere else mentally, you know, the creation of kind of a frozen ego state, which can then come up later when someone is. So here's the problem. You've got a child who learns that they can't fight or flee and they freeze. They just freeze when a parent is abusive. And then that person ages up, they grow up, developmentally look normal on the outside. And then when an event hits them that they should be able to fight or flee metaphorically, like if you have to be assertive, right? Or you just want to extricate yourself from the situation, escape it, like an abusive relationship, then you have an adult who kind of freezes up whenever there's a situation that they would need to, at that developmental level, be able to respond differently to than freezing.
So in many ways, these are sort of childhood coping mechanisms.
Yes,
that has become ingrained, and they make sort of perfect sense with the limited choices that we have as children. And it probably kept you, I'm not safe, but safer than you could have been. But the problem is coping mechanisms have sort of, they don't work properly when you're an adult and right. You have more choices. So I'm trying to sort of say, this is a rather difficult way to put, you know, you did good, but we need to give up those old coping strategies because they're just not working for you now. Am I in the right area here?
You're exactly in the right area. And I would use the metaphor. It's like you have a utility knife and you have multiple blades that can come out and you've got the little scissors attachment on it, right? Like the Swiss Army knives. It's like, as an adult, you don't just need that. You need the blade, you need the nail file, you need to have, and that all represents the personality because, you know, the knife itself is the person and you have different states you can switch into. And people often ask, does that mean I have, you know, multiple identities? Because that's a common myth. It's like, no, we all have ego states. We're conscious of how we behave in different situations, but we'll like take a step back and say, what came over me? Well, what came over you was an automatic nervous system response that was set, laid down, the foundation of which was laid down earlier in life. And so I like to honor clients' defenses and say, yeah, this kept you safe then, but it's like having one song in a playlist. You need to be able to have other things in your repertoire to build, hey, a meaningful life, we could say, right? What's meaning if there's this kind of automatic response to things without the ability to choose?
Yeah, you get hijacked by the past. So I think it might help us to understand what's going on in the brain when we get hijacked by the past. So help us out.
Absolutely. So what goes on in the brain is there's less cortical functioning and more emotional response occurring. There's amygdala activation, which is that emotional center. There's that sympathetic nervous system response, which the fight or flight sort of thinking that occurs there is very limited and extremely focused on the now. And so people can kind of get caught in this eternal now with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and be focused on momentary survival, which isn't a very sustainable lifestyle. We also see in borderline personality disorder, people can be very hypervigilant and focused on just now and not some of that more future-focused thinking.
So you're a specialist in EMDR. Let's just remind ourselves of what that stands for. Eye movement desensitization and reprogramming. So how does that work and how does it fit with trauma?
Absolutely. So EMDR therapy was discovered kind of principally in 87 by Francine Shapiro, the founder, who noticed that her eyes darted around some trees while she was taking a walk in a park, which was really a fortuitous thing for us. So I'll walk you through what happens with the most prescient, most well-known parts of the desensitization. So your listeners can think of desensitization. They can think of exposure therapy as kind of being exposed to your fears, riding out that initial anxiety, and then coming out the other side, right? And so with EMDR, we have people think, we have them dial up like a signal, connect to the Wi-Fi signal, so to speak, of a memory through the thoughts, the emotions, the body sensations. But we have someone bring up the elements of a memory, and then we have them engage in what we call, big phrase here, bilateral, just side to side, stimulation, while so simultaneously they're holding that memory. And what ends up happening is as they ride out like a wave, that memory, while moving their eyes, typically side to side, back and forth, left to right, there's a descent, a decline in the vividness and emotionality of that memory. And so that's a key ingredient of EMDR therapy. And there's been much research about it. What we're discovering, so there's this idea that it taxes the working memory. So we can only keep so much in mind at once with the working memory. Like it's like having a bunch of computer tabs open. The more you open, the slower YouTube will go as you watch it. Like if you're taxing your brain's RAM that way. So distraction, the eye movement takes away from the emotion you can focus on. So that's one hypothesis. What's really exciting, though, is that we have some evidence that the eye movements activate a part of the brain that compete with the amygdala. So we have this effect of decline in emotion as we get that eye movement going side to side. And so I know Huberman has talked about that. Andrew Huberman's talked about that recently. And I'm really excited for that. That's a new thing that we've discovered. It also replicates slow wave sleep to an extent, we think, with some of the amygdala and hippocampal functions. So the impact of EMDR therapy is that we no longer experience the emotions the same as the memory. It's still there. We haven't deleted the memory, but it declines in that emotional vividness.
Is it stored in a different way, the memory, after EMDR?
Yes. So typically, the memory is stored as this episodic, very emotionally distressing memory with it has this vividness attached as if you're there. But when it comes to after EMDR therapy, it's more of a semantic element. It's more a factual thing that occurred that is replaced in time. So with EMDR, we have like it's eye movement desensitization, right? So we know the eye movement part. We just talked about that. Okay, so there's the desensitization, just talk about that reprocessing. So that's the R in EMDR therapy. And so what that means is when you've desensitized this memory and taken out this emotional vividness, it's then reprocessed, restored in a different way, reconsolidated. The memory's reconsolidated in a different fashion where you can look back at it and it's like, it's no longer this time travel that occurs, and instead we can look at it on a timeline, and it's in the past.
So what else do you do beyond EMDR to help your clients with trauma?
I really enjoy using DBT skills, and so for the listener, dialectical behavior therapy. So I enjoy teaching clients mindfulness exercises. I like to draw from behavioral activation therapy quite a bit. So help clients to chart out and be creative in what they think could be helpful and useful that they might not feel is going to be helpful or useful. Like, well, I think that I would enjoy, you know, writing a song or getting back into music writing, but, you know, I don't think it would feel better. As we know, we're bad at emotional forecasting as human beings. And so we will think, well, I'm always going to feel this negative, and it's not typically accurate. So I love to go through clients and say, well, let's just imagine this would make you feel better because it has before. So can we kind of get back into that again? I'm a big fan of that model. And also, like I said, of DBT, ACT, that's a great, we're looking at people's life values. My gosh, we don't do that nearly enough. Getting a little philosophical there.
So do you see a big difference in the way that trauma affects women and the way it affects men, or is there no gender difference?
That's a brilliant question. So I would say there is sort of a trope, a cliche, but I've seen this in my own practice to an extent where women are often socialized to be more open and talk about it. And there's a sadness quality there that may be more acknowledged. Whereas with men, there may be more anger that can come out, or there can be a different level of conversation about it. Now, I honor both responses, obviously. I think what we label trauma may differ. Sometimes both of those genders can medicate with substance use. We see that. But often it's kind of more socially appropriate across Western culture, really a lot of cultures, that with men, maybe that manifests as anger and more of this, like, you'll never do this to me again sort of response.
So often a lot of self-medicating going along with trauma.
Yes, absolutely. Experiencing any kind of abuse or trauma can really increase substance use risk. I mean, that's a huge thing there that can just essentially cause people to engage in risky behaviors. So when you have constant fight or flight activation and not as much of the foresight of that prefrontal cortex, right, then people can reach for what is going to be the quickest way to settle down that life or death sort of physical experience. And honestly, why not? That's a terrible way to live.
Now, I'm sort of sitting thinking of lots of clients that I've had over the years, and I'm trying to decide whether if one partner has trauma, that generally the other partner has trauma as well, because sort of birds of a feather flock together. Or do you tend to get one partner who's had trauma and the other one who hasn't, and it's a sort of a case of opposites attract? What are your thoughts on this?
So my thoughts on it would be people fit together like puzzle pieces in interesting ways. And so you have someone who may have more of a codependent placation trauma response that has been ingrained, like you talked about with Susan Swartz and the as-if personality, and I loved that. And it was in that episode about imposter syndrome. And you have like that formation of someone who learned, I need to go along and give a performance and make other people comfortable. So you can look at that. You can look at what formed that as sort of developmental trauma. And you could say, well, all right, what kind of person is someone like that possibly going to draw, or what are they not going to, say, step off to, right? Maybe a domineering partner. And so that domineering partner may have learned early on that the only person you can trust is yourself, and, you know, to live in a certain way that's very self-protective. And that could have been due to a traumatic experiences as well, right? And so that's a case of two people interlocking due to different responses to earlier trauma. And so you can see birds of a feather flocking together for sure. And you can also see someone who has been through traumatic events clinging to those who are, I guess more, you could say, more neurotypical, and couples being confused because one partner experiences such vivid reactions to stuff the other one just doesn't get.
Yeah, I mean, that can be really difficult when one person sort of explodes and yes, then, you know, it's over and done with. And the other person is left dealing with all the wreckage, and they can't actually just sweep it away after the explosion like that. And they have a sort of a long-term impact for it. So, you know, it might seem that it works really well. You've got somebody who's dealing mm-hmm. with trauma and somebody who's is not going to react in the same kind of way. And obviously, two people jumping off the building at the same time is not going to be helpful. But that explosion and somebody else traumatized by the explosion is not very helpful either.
No, it's not.
I get this phrase thrown around, which is another social media phrase, and I'm sort of about it. And that is trauma bonding. First of all, what do they mean and what is it?
Okay, right. So trauma bonding, interesting phrase. typically, so I've heard it used in multiple ways, and I think that's due to just kind of that confusion around a term, people making up wording. So really what it means, where it started out, is this idea that a person forms a deep emotional bond with someone that causes them harm. And so you can look at it as an abusive relationship cycle too. You know, there's that mounting, developing connection, and then something happens and the other person maybe strikes that other, that the traumatizer in this role strikes the person, or is very unkind, verbally explodes, and then, you know, makes up for it. And you've got kind of a very familiar, just what we used to call like the abuse cycle.
But I've also had it used in, you know, I've got a trauma and he's got a trauma, I've got a trauma and she's got a trauma, and therefore right. Our connection is our mutual trauma rather than I don't like the phrase, but I'm going to use it, healthy connection.
Right. So that's the other use of it. So I heard that first use of it that we just talked about, which can kind of get into analytic stuff. But that second one of, I heard that phrase is like sharing war stories, like in group therapy, you'll talk about like bonding over war stories, and then you'll say, let's keep that minimal because that can go off into some negative space. And so essentially the trauma bonding there of, well, I had this happen, you had this happen. Why would that be a negative thing? Well, if that sets the frame and that sets expectations, even unconsciously, of like, this is what life is, and you can't trust anyone. I mean, you can already see there's going to be a toxicity in that, and really dwelling on it. What we think about the most is what we tend to move toward or expect. And so people need to realize that. Like, you can't say, I'm not going to think about a pink elephant constantly. You're going to be thinking about it. So if we think about what we don't want constantly, that's what populates our mind and our frame of, and is our frame of reference. And so I would say with that kind of trauma bonding, sure, you can validate one another's experiences initially and even say, well, we never want this to happen in our family. But then I would say move toward positivity bonding, positive expectation bonding. What do we want? What are the solid implementable steps and things that we can do that build a sustainable, meaningful life?
Excellent. In a few seconds, we're going to look at a practical situation and see if there is trauma there and what can be done about it.
The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. Please follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and visit our website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, where you can join our supporters club and unlock bonus material and other benefits.
So if you'd like to participate in The Meaningful Life, you can go to my website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast. You'll find a place to sign up for our newsletter to find more details about forthcoming programs that way. And you can go to the section that says participate and send a letter in. And this is the one I've got for today. My husband recently passed away. I found evidence of him having cheated on me because I found condoms in his bag. Since he's deceased, I can't ask him. So now I'm left to make up details. I obsess over them. I believe the affair was 2 years ago when we were having a rough time. I know he loved me, but I still can't get the images and thoughts of his betrayal out of my mind. I can't eat or sleep and I cry constantly. How do I stop obsessing and go back to remembering the love we shared and the life we built together of almost 40 years?
Yes. Okay. So first of all, just acknowledging the complexity of this situation. I mean, there's of course some elements of trauma there. I mean, I would wonder if we have some, I mean, almost think complicated grief, but it sounds like that might make more of an impact of the trauma. But regardless of the labels, you know, I thought about this vignette, the situation, and I think there's a few things that may be helpful. So though, seeing that there's a dual grief process there of two losses there. There was the loss of the husband physically and that ability to respond and maybe talk this out, and the loss of that image and of that, there was the infidelity there that can't be worked through at this point. And so this might be a good kind of jump in point for, I mean, EMDR therapy, which helps to desensitize maybe the moment that she discovered the condoms and any negative thoughts she had that were self-directed. Like anything that comes up, like, I'm not enough. Like the person with EMDR therapy thinks of the memory, the thoughts that are directed toward themselves, like that, like, you know, I wasn't enough or something, and then desensitize the memory that way. And so we're not getting rid of the memory. We're desensitizing the emotional process and the self-directed quality of the memory. And so finding an EMDR therapist, desensitizing that moment of impact, so to speak, of discovering the infidelity. And so reconsolidating that memory is, wait, this was terrible. This occurred. It's part of my late husband's complicated legacy, but I'll be able to eat, right? Be able to sleep. So that acute quality, that intrusive part of that memory, putting that behind and being able to, again, say, this is never okay that this happened, but this visceral response that I'm having can kind of be behind me in some way.
And I'm wondering as well if this is triggering earlier losses as well, because bereavement often triggers other bereavements and other losses. And I think it's important to look at it in the bigger picture as well as the individual particular loss and the particular, as we're saying, trauma.
Absolutely. So the accumulated elements there of loss coming together in one big snowball that has to kind of be melted. I think that's a great way of looking at it. And I mean, just the acknowledgement that the husband, like, we don't know what was going on. We know that he ultimately was with her. And so there was some dalliances occurring, if that, and that's extremely painful. There's a betrayal trauma there, really. But what is his legacy in totality? And just the permission to actually just recognize how terrible it was can be very cathartic. And then moving into, like, what do I want to keep from this? What do I want my memory to be of this? And working through that with a counselor might be very helpful.
And it is perfectly okay to say that discovering infidelity is traumatic, because I think some people who've dealing with infidelity find it difficult to say that sentence.
Yes. I wonder why that is. Like, they don't want to give themselves the permission to say that it's traumatic or acknowledge it. I would say that, to be blunt with it, I mean, we can look at trauma as something that upends your worldview. So, and that's how we can, again, get away from everything that's negative being trauma. Every negative experience is not trauma. So I think most people know that, but it's hard. Like, trauma could be like, I'll know it when I'll see it, is the sort of definition. And that's not it. When something impacts your worldview and the narrative you have fundamentally about your place in the world and your safety, then I would qualify that as a traumatic event. So what more than infidelity and questioning everything? Trauma is almost like this malware or virus that impacts your operating system and has you wondering, what is going on? How do I survive in this world?
And with infidelity, there's lots of triggers where things that are relatively harmless on the surface, like, you know, your husband's 5 minutes late from getting home, can actually trigger huge, huge emotional responses, because it's actually bringing back that sense of, can I trust what's happening? Is the world as I see it? Which is what comes a lot from infidelity trauma.
Yes. And I've noticed this. I work with individuals, so I get part of the story, right? I'll work with people who survived that betrayal, and there's the, or someone who was unfaithful. And so I hear about the cycle of, well, there was an unfaithful partner, so then they try to be on their best behavior, right? As a way to make restitution and to just really be the partner that they're meant to be. And, you know, go overboard with saying where they are. And there's almost the anxious attachment of the person who was cheated on. And then a cycle of fighting over, I can't trust you. You know, you were home 5 minutes late. And then that person who cheated being like, oh my gosh, what can I do to ever make this right? It's hopeless. And then the person who was cheating, I'm like, yeah, it's hopeless. And so there's a really negative feedback loop. It's actually technically a positive feedback loop because it's additive. Like, it's adding on and accelerating that vicious cycle.
And I don't think our society is very good at actually honoring bereavement, that we are expected to get over it in a very short space of time. I lost my partner almost 30 years ago, and it still has an impact today. My father died 2.5 years ago now. And, you know, I'm still working through that, you know, despite the fact he was 91 and sort of, you know, lived a very full life. Yet there is still a lot of pain to work through on that, because your world has been upended. And to have the two at the same time, I think is really tough. And I'm concerned about the amount of support you're getting, because this idea that you can't do anything about it because he's not here to ask him, yeah, that would help, but that would just be the first step in the journey. So he can't be there to provide the information, and you're making the journey right on your own, but that doesn't mean that you can't make it with somebody. I think it's really difficult to do it on your own, but to work with a therapist who's used to dealing with infidelity and sort of honoring your losses. And I think with the whole of this trauma business, in whatever form it takes, we do have to honor the pain. And it's a really difficult boundary between honoring the pain and not re-traumatizing yourself with it. And I've suddenly thought of a very good question for you, Jeremy. How do we honor the pain without actually taking people back and re-traumatizing them with it?
Great question. So I look at re-traumatization as continually going into the past with no tether to the present. Okay. So with EMDR therapy, we go back into the past and descend into that well, but we're tethered. It's like belaying, it's like rappelling, going down the cliff with that tether. And so we can tug and we can go up. Right. And that can be a therapist helping us to go up out of it. It can be ourselves. It can be, it's kind of rough. It's like you said, it's very difficult to go through that stuff alone. So to go back to the past and relay down and say, you know, I'm going to honor this. I'm going to set a time maybe to think about this traumatic incident or loss or, you know, grief, and journal about, we know journaling is so therapeutic. And then I'm going to think on something that I want to come of life, that I want in the present. That can be very useful to honor things. I have clients ask me if they should burn letters that they were going to send someone. I say, if it will make you angrier and dwell on it more, probably not. If it will induce a sense of finality or completeness, then yes, that may be useful. So there's something in psychology called the Zeigarnik effect, which was named after the person who discovered it. And it's this idea that we remember incomplete things, things that we were interrupted in, which can be trauma, by the way, better than complete events, complete actions. And so we remember things we have to do, like a to-do list. And so what can help to honor a loss, like this thing was incomplete, but I want to give some sense of closure, is going to be different than dwelling on the gap and, well, this is not here and I'm never going to have it. And it's like, how do you look to the past while moving to the in the present toward the future? I would say that is the way to look at honoring the past and not getting immersed in it like you're there.
And I think it's really important to say, tell your therapist, this is really difficult. I don't know if I really want to go there. And the therapist can walk you to the door. And if you decide you don't want to open the door, that's fine. And, you know, you might actually, certainly when I've had clients with very painful stories, you know, I say, just give me the headline so I know what's behind the door. So we've got it's got a name, you know, so like sexual abuse or car crash or whatever it is. But we don't actually have to open the door. We don't have to see all the details. We don't have to see the mangled metal sort of kind of thing. Or maybe on one particular day, you do want to look at the mangled metal. It's sort of, I think it's up to you. You are the person that knows you best. The therapist is there to sort of be your support. And so if you want to go to mangled metal, that's fine. If you don't, that's also fine. It's a question of actually what you need. And it probably will depend week to week, day to day, maybe even minute to minute. And if you feel relaxed and able, I think that that is very empowering. So it's really important to say, no, the therapist might know a lot about therapy, but he or she is not an expert on you. That's you. And that's, you know, that's important for all types of therapy, not just when we're dealing with trauma.
Yes, you nailed it. I would absolutely throw in there, we therapists have to be aware that the therapeutic world is an echo chamber. We interact with other therapists and psychiatrists. We talk about this stuff almost like ER doctors. We're so used to it, but our clients may never think about things to the extent that we think that they may be repressing things. We have to honor that and say, hey, I'm not here to just strip your defense mechanisms away. I'm here to help you to slowly replace them in a way where you can tell me if we're going too quickly. Like, please let me know, because I'm invested in your healing process and not on my timeline. That's crucial. That dual awareness too, of whenever clients are starting to feel in the past, when they're discussing the past, keeping them in the present, one foot in the past, one in the present. That's a mantra of EMDR therapy and of good therapy in general.
So final thoughts on trauma. If we were going to take away one thought with us, what's that one thought?
Okay. I would say that trauma is created when there's like an interrupted action impulse. You feel trapped and you feel unsafe. So that's the formula. If you go choose to be on a roller coaster, right, then you're choosing to be restricted, but you know you're going to be safe if you enjoy roller coasters. Okay. If you feel unsafe, but you can escape, the brain does not typically encode that as traumatic the way it would if you're frozen and have to see something or feel unsafe. And so that's not much of a good final thought, is it? Well, you can look in your life and say, okay, this happened to me. How can I introduce a sense of freedom and work through that event? How can I give myself freedom of mobility, just moving? How can I see this as something where I'm not trapped and I'm safe now? How can I feel a present sense of safety?
Beautiful thoughts. So we haven't finished, because there's some bonus material to come. But before we do that, I need to ask you, as a witness here on The Meaningful Life, what makes your life meaningful?
So I greatly enjoy making psychotherapy fun and authentic, creating new ideas, metaphors for the field. So to get more personal, I really enjoy authentically understanding others and not just surface level stuff and being understood, right? Like, I'm a therapist, yes. I value humor. I value going to concerts, music shows, things like that. Just authentic living makes my life meaningful.
Beautiful. Authentic life and meaningful life going hand in hand. And on the subject of things that go hand in hand, I'm afraid these are two negatives that go hand in hand. We're going to look at the link between anxiety and trauma. We haven't really talked very much about anxiety, but I'm afraid to say that tends to come hand in hand with trauma. So if you'd like to find out more about that, you can hear the bonus material by subscribing directly via Apple or Spotify. And also, you can become a supporter of The Meaningful Life and you can unlock the bonus material that way. So here are the details.
You've been listening to The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall. You can follow Andrew on Twitter, like him on Facebook, and please leave a review wherever you consume your podcasts. Making, editing, and distributing The Meaningful Life comes with substantial costs, and we'd like to ask for your help. Visit our website, andrewgmarshall.com/podcast, where you can join our supporters club and unlock bonus material for every program, send in a letter to be discussed by Andrew and his guests, and join a community of other people seeking to make their life meaningful. At the gold level, you get even more benefits. Production of The Meaningful Life with Andrew G. Marshall is by Michael Dooney. Social media by Madeleine Healy. Sound engineering and theme tune by Sebastian de la Luz Mendoza. And I'm Susie Colick. Please tell your friends and spread the word. Thank you.